the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, and we're here bringing you this great radio every week talking about health, wellness, issues in our planet and our own body and the health and wellness of our cells and ourselves, as we say. And we're really glad you joined us. And we have an interesting guest today. We're going to be talking a lot about environmental health and maybe touch into politics and things like that, marine biology, which I had an opportunity as an undergrad to be a marine biology major before I decided to become a naturopathic physician. And we have author Dan Egan on the radio today, and he's the author of this great book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. And Dan is a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and is a senior water policy fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. He has twice been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and he's going to be talking about the Great Lakes, which we know provides the largest source of fresh water in the world, as well as food, work, and fun for tens of millions of people. Yet they're under great threat as never before and getting worse. We're going to be talking about their history and their troubles, which is spreading like a virus down America's waterways. And just like Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, Dan's book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, like we're going to be discussing today, is a master reporter's landmark work that takes the readers through science, politics, history, and economics of the lakes. And it may reveal an economic and ecological catastrophe happening right before our eyes unless we can do something. Dan, welcome to the program. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about, I know you're a reporter, and how you ended up kind of writing this really interesting book, which kind of reads like a epic story, talking about going back to the even the geological history of the Great Lakes, which are basically seas in a way, and how you ended up writing a great book from that.
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I'm a native of Green Bay, Wisconsin, and so I'm a Wisconsin guy, but the first 10 years of my reporting career took me out west to Utah and Idaho, where I kind of got steeped in the culture of reporting on environmental issues, everything from grizzly bear restoration in northern Idaho to the wolf recovery in Yellowstone and salmon. Endangered salmon recovery efforts in Idaho. And so I did a lot of that kind of coverage, and then I came back to my home state in 2002 as a, they called it a super general assignment feature writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which basically meant I got to kind of select the longer features that I'd write. And it was pretty much unconscious. I just started writing stories about the lakes, people who made their livings on the lakes, the ecological health of the lakes, the history of navigation on the lakes, to the point that it eventually became my beat. They gave me this beat. It was called the Great Lakes, and it was all manner of issues facing the lakes. And I plodded along with that for about a decade, and then this book was really born out there in New York City. I took a year leave from the paper to do a fellowship / master's degree program at Columbia University. And part of that program was a book writing seminar taught by a professor named Sam Friedman. And he takes about 16 students a year, and he's got a really good track record of getting contracts for these students of his. I mean, I think when I was there, he was running at about 25%. We're if not leaving his class with contracts, we're getting one soon after. And so I found myself in this class, and I was a little burned out. You can only cover something for so long, and I had kind of lost the fascination for the lakes that I brought with me back from Idaho and Utah and Wyoming. And so I'd be sitting around this table up on the Upper West Side at the Columbia campus there and telling stories about, what we've done to this, the world's largest freshwater surface ecosystem. And people, they were from all over the country and all over the world, really, were just kind of blown away. And so that feedback kind of energized me. And one thing led to another. I did my proposal. I've said this before, and I'm serious. I was out there with my wife and four young kids. The oldest at the time was in fifth grade. So it was a stressor trying to manage all this. And I wanted to just get back to Milwaukee. I didn't really want to write a book. And so putting together this proposal was more of just an exercise, an academic exercise. But I did have a feeling that there was an interesting story there. And what happened was it made its way to an agent, which was part of this seminar. You had to go solicit an agent. And I coincidentally solicited the agent of the book seminar professor. It was pure coincidence. And and then off we went. And I took another 20 months off work to write the book. So that's a long answer, but that's where it's coming from.
Well, that's how we get engaged into our and really get our passion involved with writing and things like that. I found it interesting that in the beginning of the book you talked a lot about the geological history of the Great Lakes. They are amazing. I know. I've flown over them and been to many of them. I've never been to Lake Superior, but I've been to most of them. They're really incredible.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that they were, some of them were like 1,300 feet deep, and that they were actually 600 feet above sea level and kind of flow like a giant slow motion river west to east, and they kind of dump into eventually the Atlantic. Right?
Yeah. You know, the plumbing of the lakes is something that even people here, I'm in downtown Milwaukee right now, not a quarter mile from, you know, the Lake Michigan beach, and it's stunning how little even people who live on the lakes know about them. And so one of the challenges I had, the first thing is trying to capture their majesty with words. It's, you can't, you know, I kind of gave up. But you mentioned Lake Superior. I mean, that lake is, it's not a lake. You know,
huge.
That is a sea. It's something, and that's one of the problems that the lakes have faced, is that, you know, they've got this kind of reputation of being, oh, it's just a lake. Well, you know, you find yourself out on Lake Superior, they get waves that are 20 feet high. I mean, they've had waves sink 1,000-foot boats. Even
the
Lake
famous
Michigan,
the Edmund Fitzgerald song by Gordon Lightfoot, one of my favorite songs.
And, you know, he captures, you're just talking about kind of the plumbing of the lakes. That song is masterful. I used to just listen to it like everybody else. And then when I started covering the lakes, I started paying a little more attention. And he packs so much historical and hydrological information into that lakes, into that song. And, you know, an example is, you were mentioning that Lake Superior is, you know, well above, more than 600 feet above sea level, or just barely 600 feet above sea level, and that it's not a static system. It flows downhill, down the St. Mary's River, into Lakes Michigan and Huron, which in turn flow into Lake Erie, which dumps over Niagara Falls, which plunges into Lake Ontario, which spills out to the Atlantic Ocean in what was once a really wild torrent with standing waves that could sink, you know, steamboats. It's been largely tamed with the building of the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is really, once I discuss kind of the, you know, geological history and some of the early cultural history of the lakes, the story really takes off with the construction of the canals that we built, linking these lakes that were, vast as they are, they're collectively 94,000 square miles, which is basically the size of the UK. Nobody, unless it was World War II, would wake up in the UK and think they're just on an island. And in the same way, in the inverse way, we're not just on lakes, we're on these inland seas. And the temptation was, it's only natural, was to, like, let's make this an American Mediterranean. Let's link these in a navigational manner to the Atlantic Ocean so we can open up ports as far west or even Duluth, which is 2,300 miles inland, from the Atlantic, and we did it. We built this navigation system so you can float a, 800-foot freighter in from the, well, from anywhere in the globe, but then up the Gulf of St. Lawrence and all the way through the lakes that I just mentioned to the western end of Lake Superior, which would be Duluth or farther north, our neighbors and friends to the north, Thunder Harbor in Canada, Thunder Bay.
I think the it's interesting that they thought that these port cities on the Great Lakes would be, you know, kind of like up there with New York and a lot of the great natural harbors, and it would change commerce and you know, make things pretty famous. But it didn't seem to go that way, I guess, in your book, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, you know, if the Seaway, the St. Lawrence Seaway, was really the culmination of hundreds of years of canal building that started in the 1820s. Well, it started in the 1700s, but the first real big crack in this natural divide that the lakes had from the rest of the aquatic world was Lake Erie in 1825, I believe it opened. And then the Canadians built their own pathway to the sea in the late 1820s, 1829, I believe, with the construction of the Welland Canal. And then it was kind of almost like an arms race. Each side of the border kept building bigger and bigger canals till they got together in the 1950s and said, let's build one super canal coming in from Montreal. And so they went to work on that, which was at the time the largest earth-moving project in the history of the world. Mm. And what they were essentially doing was building a nautical lift to lift boats around Niagara Falls and then canals and channels to push them through the river systems into all the lakes and cities from Chicago, Buffalo, Toronto, Milwaukee, Green Bay. These cities really thought they were about to become world-class ports. But the problem was they built the Seaway essentially on the cheap. They built it to match some existing locks that were already in place that had been opened in the 1930s, and that pretty much locked in the size of the freighters that could get into the Great Lakes into like pre-World War II dimensions. And so this is really unfortunate and fascinating. Right in the middle of the Seaway construction, the first container vessel sails from New Jersey on its test run down to Galveston, I think. It was somewhere in Texas, but it was Malcolm McLean floating his first container vessel, which almost instantly transformed the world of shipping and demanded ever bigger boats. So you have the Seaway opening in 1959 to great fanfare. You've got President Eisenhower there. You've got the Queen there. And, you know, all this pageantry. But the reality was they basically built a narrow gauge railroad in a modern railroad world. And so The result was we still have these very big boats coming into the lakes, but they really are small boats in the world's shipping scene. And it takes a long time to get through the locks and to get all the way inland. You know, everybody's got to take their turn going through these pinch points, these exquisitely tight pinch points where the boats literally have inches on each side, and they've got to get in line. And then in the winter, they got to get in the big line because the whole system ices over. And in the modern world of shipping, you know, people want just-in-time delivery. They want to manage their inventories as they're in transit, and you can't do that with the Seaway. So the end result was, you know, the first year we got some exotic bounty. Like, I did some historical research and looked at the pictures from the ports, and you know, there's models down on the docks wearing furs from, you know, God knows where, and sailors unloading barrels of olives and all sorts of whiskey and stuff like that, or not whiskey, but exotic alcohol. And the next year, those kind of products stopped showing up. And today it's basically inbound steel, for now at least, until maybe steel imports start plummeting with tariffs, and outbound grain. But what's tragic, not just for the business at the ports and the economic vibrancy of these cities who were convinced that they were going to become like New York, rivals to New York or to Los Angeles or to Houston, was that the boats did bring stuff that wasn't listed in their manifest.
Exactly.
And that
it created like a conduit for exotic pests, which I guess you take a lot of time in your book discussing the exotic nature of the pests and how they decimated the lake. It's interesting. It's so fascinating. So, you know, I remember when I was in studying to be a marine biologist. I remember dissecting the lamprey, and my my professor, Dr. Hechtel, he was discussing the biology of the lamprey and how they were kind of like the vampires of the sea. Now, they led to a huge economic and environmental disaster. That was one of the first ones in the Great Lakes. Am I correct?
Yes, you're dead on correct. And so, yeah, we've had multiple waves, but the first wave of invasions. So just to rewind so people have it clear in their minds, without this canal building, there was no way something could swim up from the eastern seaboard into the Great Lakes. Coming up the St. Lawrence River would have been, something might have been able to make it. But so Lake Ontario had an exposure that the other lakes didn't have. But the other lakes had Niagara Falls, and nothing's going to swim around that. And on the backside, on the western side of the Great Lakes, we have what they call a subcontinental divide. But I like to think of it as a continental divide because it's not as dramatic or spectacular as the Rocky Mountains. But it's just as hydrologically and ecologically significant because it is the separation between the Mississippi River Basin and the Great Lakes. So they were like as isolated as a pond up in the Adirondacks. Big as they didn't have this interaction with the outside world. And then we got things swimming up the canals. And the first thing was the sea lamprey, which, yeah, it's been described as an aquatic vampire. And, you know, none of these critters are bad critters. They're doing what their nature built to do. They just found themselves in this really ecologically vulnerable place called the Great Lakes because they're only about 10,000 years old. I mean, the glaciers melted and carved out these basins, and then they filled up, and, you know, whatever fish could make their way in at that point before the whole system was sealed off basically at Niagara Falls is what we had. And then we built these pathways around Niagara Falls, and here come the lampreys. And so we had a relatively simple food web, and lake trout were like if we're using, you know, aquatic analogs here, they were the wolf. And they controlled the flow of energy in the whole system. They ate all the little fish, and the lampreys took out the lake trout in short order, like in 10 or 20 years. And that just led to all sorts of wacky imbalances out there on the water. And unfortunately for the lakes, right behind the lampreys came alewives, also from the eastern seaboard. And they're a little herring, and they're really small in the Great Lakes because both lampreys and alewives are anadromous. That means they spend part of their life in salt water and part of their life in fresh water, but they don't have to have that salt water component if they find big water, and that's what they found in the Great Lakes. So with nothing to eat, the alewives, and the lamprey took out the lake trout, alewives exploded into the Great Lakes. And now you have these lakes, just 90% of the biomass, as the biologists say, 9 out of 10 every pounds of fish in Lake Michigan by the 1960s were alewife, and they were dying by the billions and washing ashore and rendering beaches from Chicago up into the pristine Door County in northern Wisconsin unusable. It was just stinking flesh on the beach.
I wonder, did they get into Lake Erie? Because I remember as a kid going up to Lake Erie and seeing so many of them washed on the shore.
Yeah.
But this was like about 1968, I think. I was up at Lake Erie. I was a wee lad with my parents.
Was,
I remember just the smell and the stench was just incredible.
They were broken. The lakes were just, you know, I guess they were functioning on some level, but not on any level that we would consider in some kind of balance. I mean, in Chicago, on Lake Michigan, Lake Erie in the mid-late 60s, that was the peak of the infestation. In Lake Michigan, or in Chicago, they were using bulldozers and dump trucks. They started trying to just burn them, build massive piles, scoop massive piles and dump gas on them and burn them. It was just insane. And, you know, they were actually, I never found out what the chemical was, but there were news accounts at the time of up in Wilmette and, you know, some of the tonier areas north of Chicago, but on the lake, they were trying to perfume the beaches because people lived near it, and it was putrefying. You know, it was,
sure.
It was
5 feet thick of rotting fish. Was
yeah.
I remember the smell till this day. I mean, you know, that was a long time ago, and I remember that like it was yesterday. That scene of these silver looking fish, just feet thick high, all along the shore of Lake Erie. And I remember we were going to go for a swim there. My dad said, "I don't think so." So we walked.
It would be crazy.
So I wanted to ask you a question about lampreys.
Yeah,
now, when they hatch onto the trout, they only have like small teeth and like a tongue that's like a serrated rasp. Do they actually kill the trout, or do they just make the trout more susceptible to disease? I'm just trying to paint picture that,
both.
You know, kind of like our own bodies, you know, our show is a health show. It kind of, it sort of weakens the body in a way.
Both. They did both. They would literally kill them. They would suck the blood out of them to the point where, you know, they couldn't carry on, or they would latch on for a while. And at some point, for some reason, you know, nobody's really able to see what's going on under these waves, but, you know, they would break loose. And so sometimes they would just significantly weaken the lake trout. And it wasn't just lampreys. I mean, the lake trout were heavily, heavily fished in the 1940s, right when the lampreys arrived. And interestingly enough, that was because, you know, it was dangerous to go out on the coast during World War II to go out, you know, and get fish. And so the nation was depending on the lakes for a bunch of protein. And so we fished them hard. But yeah, you're right. Lampreys both killed and weakened. And had this situation been left to, you know, nature, perhaps, you know, you can see evolution real fast. And we can talk about that later, some things that are going on. But there probably could have been strains of lake trout that might have figured out how to live long enough to reproduce, to keep a, you know, some kind of a remnant population going on. Mm. But we weren't going to wait and see. We decided to, when you're talking about things in a holistic way and in an overall health way, we decided to create basically a kind of chemotherapy, if you will.
Yeah,
to kill the, to target the lampreys. And so they, you know, lampreys are like, They have one fossil that's 360 million years old, and so it's a little smaller. It's significantly smaller than today's lamprey, which are about, you know, maybe 2 feet long in the Great Lakes. I think they can get bigger in the ocean. But
how about chemicals? How about chemicals, Dan? Because I know, like, you know, I know up in Rochester, there's you know, the old I think it's Kodak
there.
I think there was a time that the Great Lakes were extremely polluted with probably sewage and other things, but many chemicals during the industrial time.
Yeah, I mean, the Cuyahoga River, famously in Cleveland, famously, you know, went up in flames in 1969.
So the actual river burned.
The river burned. It had so much oil and crap on it. But here's the thing about that kind of pollution is that it's reversible. I mean, the damage that it does, you can, you know, it decays and disperses. You can also target, contaminated sediments, and you can fix that. You know, you're never going to restore it to its pristine beauty of, you know, the 1500s, but you know, 40 million people still mostly, and we can talk about this a little bit too, if you want, but rely on the Great Lakes for their drinking water today. It's where Chicago gets its water. It's where Toronto gets its water. It's where Milwaukee gets its water, Buffalo. We weathered that wave of pollution. And what I like to think of this invasive species wave that we've been talking about is a biological pollution, and that's a tougher nut to crack because it doesn't decay or disperse, and you can't plug a pipe or cap a smokestack and start working toward a healing. It breeds, it spreads, evolves. So it's a tough nut to crack, but we did crack it with a chemical, and we did develop. I was mentioning these lampreys, you know, they're old, ancient creatures, and that means they have an old, ancient liver design, and that made them uniquely vulnerable to a certain kind of chemical. And they figured out where the lampreys were spawning, and they started poisoning these rivers with a toxin that should make everybody feel good, I guess, called lampricide. So
yeah,
I mean, they really wanted to convey the message that it's lamprey-specific, and it is, to a large degree, lamprey-specific. So so we got control of the lamprey in the late 1960s, and then it was time to get control of the alewives. And then we brought in
salmon.
Did they bring in some type of salmon? Medical analogy. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of an elegant solution. It wasn't more poison. It was, well, let's bring in a predator that's kind of nature built to eat these schooling ocean herring called alewives.
Right.
So, you know, lake trout, there were remnant populations of lake trout that hung on in Lake Superior and in some pockets of the lakes. But they were essentially gone by the time the lampreys were done with them. But we could have started a hatchery program focused exclusively on lake trout and let them get control of the alewives. But you know, some biologists of the time, this is the 1960s, and it's a kind of a can-do era. They thought, let's bring in Pacific salmon. So just imagine this. You got these Atlantic herring swimming in the middle of the continent in fresh water, and we bring in Pacific salmon to chase the Atlantic herring in all this fresh water. And so they literally flew them in from Oregon, started hatchery programs, and started planting them annually. And voila, it worked.
Oh, it did work. It wasn't a disaster.
It wasn't.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
It created this remarkable, remarkable productive fishery because there were just ungodly amounts of alewives out there. And the salmon, just as the biologists were hoping and guessing, were chased after them. And so for a good 40 years, I mean, all the way up until today, and now it's starting to fall apart. And that's kind of... it's tragic for the recreational fishing industry and for all the charter boat captains and the hotel owners and gas stations and restaurants and all these coastal towns. But it's like I mentioned, waves of invasive species. It's a modern wave. It's the invasive species that didn't swim into the lakes. It's the ones that were brought in by these boats that
right,
are finally
being the zebra and
exactly
wagamussel.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about that for a few minutes, about how the mussels were brought in from the Black Sea. Because it's interesting that these are freshwater mussels, and so they couldn't have been on the bottom of a boat going across the Atlantic and Mediterranean because the salt water would have killed them. But somehow they managed to get transplanted from the Europe and Euro-Asia to the Great Lakes.
Yeah, so on the other side of the Atlantic, they did the same thing that we've been doing with the Great Lakes for hundreds of years, and that's they plumbed it. So there's a canal system there, and I don't know off top of my head what the salinity tolerance of these mussels are, but yeah, I mean they can tolerate some salt, they can tolerate a lot for a little while, they just clam up, but they can tolerate some, but they do really well in fresh water, and so they got picked up in some fresh water. Estuary or somewhere in the Black Sea Basin and moved around Europe. And then in the 1980s, the first one was discovered in, it's a tiny little lake on this flow between Lake Huron to Lake Erie. There's kind of like an embolism in the river system. It's called Lake St. Clair. And that's where they found the first zebra mussel in 1986. And, you know, in a matter of like 15 years, they became the dominant species in the lake, along with their hardier cousin, the quagga mussel. And so what they do is each one of these things can filter like a liter of water a day. And if you look at one, it's like the size of your pinky nail, maybe as big as your thumbnail. And you think, how can an organism like this cause that much disruption or damage? And you got to look at them. Let's stick with this health analogy. You look at them as cells, as like, you know, some kind of superorganism. They now smother the bottom of, say, Lake Michigan. They're not on the beaches because of the waves. They can't attach on the beaches. But you go out about a half a mile, and you could walk 80 miles over to Michigan, which is basically the distance between Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to Muskegon, Michigan. on a bed of these mussels at densities, and this will blow your mind, at densities of up to 100,000 per square meter. And you think, well, wait a minute, how could 100,000 fit, you know, physically fit on that square meter? They cluster. They like, it's like a gnarling kind of coral. They go, you know, three-dimensional.
Wow.
So there's these thick clusters of mussels that are just filtering the heck out of the lake and the lakes, but I'm talking specifically of Lake Michigan right now. And the result is Lake Michigan looks like the Caribbean today. I mean, it is gorgeous. It's just this kind of cobalt blue. It's so clear. It's approaching some of the clearest freshwater on the planet now. And a lot of people like it. You know, people who would just basically fly over it or stand on a bluff and look at it. They really, you know, they think it's attractive, but this isn't the sign of a healthy lake. It's the sign of a lake that's having the life literally sucked out of it. And so they've knocked plankton levels down to like 10% of their historic average. And that's the foundation of the food chain. So everything above it is suffering, including the aforementioned alewives. And now because the alewives aren't finding enough to eat, no, neither are the salmon, and that whole system is collapsing again.
So we're going to need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about how that led to dinoflagellate blooms and toxic water.
Sure.
and more collapse of the stream. And then we'll also talk about politrix, as I call it, the idea of where is the water coming from to irrigate the Southwest, and are they looking at the Great Lakes, and what is that going to do? And so water wars and all those things. So stay right here tuned to Natural Alternatives and the Natural Nurse Dr. Z Show. We'll be back. Stay with us.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
Okay. How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine test.
Because we're in the midst of a great conversation with Dan Egan, and he is the author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. And the Great Lakes, Erie, Huron, Michigan, Ontario, Superior, hold 20% of the world's supply of surface fresh water and provide sustenance, work, and recreation for tens of millions of Americans. But they're under threat. And this threat is not only spreading across the continent, but is an idea that the microcosm equals the macrocosm. It's sort of what's going on with the planet. And so when we talk about things like the Flint water crisis and the California drought and the politics of safe, clean water, we have Dan Egan here to write a great and powerful wake-up call for us all. So welcome back, Dan. It's been a great conversation so far. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So we talked about, let's talk more about the muscle. So when they clean the waters, they get rid of the this is what happens in the Caribbean, and the coral do the same thing. They clean the waters and they're nice and clear, but now you add some pollution to that water and you have growth of more toxic algae, which then create all kinds of imbalances.
Well, yeah. So I had mentioned earlier this idea of biological pollution. And here's a really good example of that. So these mussels are brainless, but they are smart enough to not eat bad types of algae. You can see these videos on YouTube where they're sucking literally everything out of the water until certain flecks come by and they just spit that out.
Wow.
And, you know, they know that that's not nutritious. And what that is a toxic kind of algae called microcystis. It's a blue-green algae, which is really a photosynthesizing bacteria. It's ancient, but it creates this toxin that is, you know, it's nasty stuff. It's a liver toxin, but it's also increasingly, and I don't know enough to speak intelligently about this, but I am going to pursue some research. It's been linked to some neurological degenerative diseases, like, you know, if not ALS, similar stuff.
Wow.
And, you know, they don't have they've just got clusters near lakes that are heavily infested with this nasty algae. So, but I'm not going to speak too much about that right now. But it's poisonous enough that you can't drink it. And so what's been happening in recent years now is that, you know, Lake Erie has always been subject to these nasty algae blooms because of over-fertilization. And that fertilization originally came, oddly enough, from detergents. Back in the 1960s, detergents were filled with phosphates, which is really a big component in agriculture fertilizer. So it was spawning these algae outbreaks. Well, today those algae outbreaks are back because we've dealt with the detergent issue. But there's more coming off the landscape from agriculture, particularly in the western basin of Lake Erie. So that fuels algal blooms. And the problem is when, you know, in the 1960s, you might have had a whole assemblage of species, algae species, that were making, you know, great use of this phosphorus. Now it's pretty much just this toxic microcystis because the mussels have basically selected for that. They've eaten everything else. So you get these blooms. And I was in Toledo in 2014 when one of these blooms got sucked into the Toledo drinking water, primary drinking water intake on Lake Erie before the operators of the drinking water system could realize what's happening. This colorless, odorless stuff got into the pipes and they had to issue a do not drink order for some 500,000 people. And this wasn't just boil it, we'll get the system purged and everything will be fine. You boil this stuff, you just increase the concentration of the toxin. You also can't, like, expose your skin to it. So there's no showering. There's no drinking water. You've got, you know, this boil order went out, like, at 1 or 2 in the morning on a Saturday morning, and by 7 o'clock, the stores were just empty of bottled water, as far north as Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is, like, an hour away. And so you had the Army, the National Guard, bringing in baby formula by the pallets and, you know, trucks, tanker trucks filled with water. And it was 2 or 3 days before they got things under control. But that was a really frightening situation, to think that you're living on the edge of the world's largest freshwater system, and it's just been poisoned to the point where it's not safe for you to even take a sip after it goes through a treatment plant. So, yeah, I mean, that's one example of these mussels causing this kind of chemical mischief that is every bit as, you know, vexing and dangerous as what was happening to the lakes during the industrial plundering of the middle of the 20th century. And I got some other examples, too, if you want to hear about them.
Sure, sure, yeah. Interesting.
Okay, yeah, so these mussels have cleared up the water to the point that now a certain type of algae in certain areas and other lakes thrives on the bottom. And this algae is called cladophora. And it's basically like a seaweed. And so that's just exploding in pristine areas of the Great Lakes, and it eventually dies. And when it dies, it burns up all this oxygen, which opens the door to botulism bacteria that thrives in an anoxic environment. Well, the mussels are still down there, and they can survive low oxygen levels for periods. And so they survive, and they're unaffected by this botulism bacteria. So they'll suck up the botulism, and then yet another type of invader comes along. It's called the round goby, which came from the same place as the mussels, the Black and Caspian Sea Basin. And they eat these now, you know, botulism-containing mussels. And they die, they float to the surface, and then, you know, eagles, loons, grebes, ducks come along, not so much ducks, but, and they eat these fish, and then they become poisoned with botulism. So you've got, you know, in recent years, tens of thousands of birds dying and just littering these otherwise pristine beaches in remote areas of the Great Lakes. It's you know, scary.
Wow. So what about, let's talk a little bit about politics, you know, because
okay. Well,
we know the president is cutting and gutting the EPA and things like that, and I know a lot of eco-journalists have talked about, you know, what are we going to do to, and then, of course, let's talk also about the politics of fresh water towards the tail end of the program here.
Yeah, okay, yeah, and I do want to leave your listeners with, you know, where we are today. So we'll get to that, because this is scary stuff, but it's not all bad.
Yeah.
I mean, there are good positive things happening. But yeah, the politics of the water, who owns the world's largest freshwater system and who's got a right to use it?
Right.
And it's a good question. And it's basically the states and the provinces that surround the Great Lakes.
Yeah, but doesn't Canada own half of it, Dan? Because it's half Canadian. I think there's only one lake that's American, Lake Michigan, and the rest of them are all half Canadian, half American.
Yep, yeah. So it's the states and the provinces who really, you know, I guess legally own the water. And, oh boy, it was probably 10 years ago that they got together, and they crafted a compact on the U.S. side, and then the Canadians have a parallel agreement on the Canadian side that basically prohibits large-scale water diversions outside of, I mentioned earlier, the subcontinental divide. Well, you know, every lake, every system has a basin line. So the Great Lakes Basin is defined as the area that receives all the rainwater. It is defined as if a rainwater falls and then it flows into the Great Lakes, you're in the Great Lakes Basin.
Mm.
And so if you're in the Great Lakes Basin, as are, you know, all the big cities in the Great Lakes, then you're entitled to water. as you want. I mean, you're not entitled to pollute it and put it back. You can use it, treat it, and send it back, and it's kind of a virtuous loop where the lakes really, you know, aren't in danger of being drained away. But that changes if you take water beyond that basin line, because then it's not going to go through a treatment plant and come back into the lake so it can be reused again. It's gone. And so the way the law works now is only under very, very rare circumstances can you take water across that basin dividing line. And that's for certain communities that are within a certain distance of the lakes, provided that they also send the water back. So they basically engineer themselves into the basin. So they take 10 gallons. They, you know, people use it and drink it, but they, you know, most of it goes back. 8 of it goes back or so. So that's the situation that we have right now. And, you know, Congress ratified it. President Bush signed off on it. And it's the law of the land. And as I said, it's a similar situation in Canada. But what Congress gives, Congress can take. And, you know, with water crises raging from Arizona to South Africa, it's probably only a matter of time until, you know, some thirsty outsiders come calling again. And, you know, there can be an argument made like, boy, you guys have tons of water here. People are suffering. Why can't you share some? Well, you know, that gets into a whole set of tricky questions. But I guess my first answer, if we're talking about the Western United States, is, well, maybe we don't need to be growing lettuce and pistachios in the deserts. You know, there's plenty of places for agriculture to thrive where there is water. You'd never want to deny human beings water, but you may be inclined to say to an industry, if you want to keep doing business, why don't you just move to the Great Lakes? Into the basin and do it. So that's going to be an interesting thing to follow. And as a matter of fact, here in Wisconsin, there's a Foxconn, a Taiwanese-based maker of flat-screen panels, is coming here. They say nobody knows exactly if it's going to come to fruition, but they say they're going to have 13,000 jobs right on the banks of Lake Michigan. But some of that operation is going to be on the other side of the basin dividing line. So now people are arguing that maybe they shouldn't get the water. But this was kind of the idea behind the compact, that you would bring people to the water rather than water to the people. And so there's kind of a fight going on, like how much water, you know, should we let them take this water over the basin dividing line? And if they don't, that could unravel the whole deal. I mean, it could lead to... And then this whole agreement that we, you know, I think with great foresight put together a decade ago could unravel, and then it could be open season on the Great Lakes.
It seems like there are a lot of parallels with even what's going on the land with invasive species and pollution and Roundup and things like that. It's just, you know, the water cycle is so intimately connected with all the other cycles of life on the planet, that it's very difficult to, you got to be like Chief Seattle, who said, you know, if you make a change, you have to look 7 generations down the line and see if that change has created a catastrophe, or is it in, you know, holy balance with the system. And I don't think we're doing that. From looking at your book, it's just like one putting out forest after another. No one's really thinking this through, it doesn't seem like. You're the first person I've seen that has kind of opened all this up. Maybe there are a lot of scientists starting to see it through, but there's a lot of short-sighted business people that are not.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a big problem, emerging problem, is just the overdosing of the croplands with fertilizer, because, you know, if big rains hit before that fertilizer gets taken up by the crop, it goes into the water and it goes into the lakes. And that's why, you know, and it's not just store-bought fertilizer. A lot of times it's manure, you know.
It could be, yeah.
And so, yeah, that's not just a problem facing the Great Lakes. That's a problem facing waters from, you know, New York City to Seattle. And, yeah, I don't know what the answer is, except for better regulation. But we're not in an era of, you know, better regulation, are we? It's deregulate. And I think it's important for people today to know the history of, you know, I'll say the Great Lakes, but it could be the Hudson River. You know, just the kind of plundering that went on. And you know, a lot of it was largely remedied with regulation. And now we have an anti-regulation administration. And we're in danger of going backwards at the, you know, the very time when we should be going backwards.
Yeah. Well, is there anything that are we seeing any hope from scientists trying to do the right thing?
Yeah. You know, so back in the 1960s, it's interesting. I was just up in Ontario last week. Back in the 1960s, you know, there were all these algae problems, and they didn't know what exactly was causing it. Some people said it was phosphorus, phosphates, and detergent. Some people said it was nitrogen. Some people said it was carbon, and you could do lab experiments and pretty much get, you know, implicate all three of those. But the real question was, what was the limiting factor? What was, you know, the one thing that if you reduced would really stop the algae bloom? So the Canadian government, this is wild. They set aside, it's like 800 square miles and it's like dozens of lakes, like 57 lakes or something, and they use them as test tubes. So they have whole ecosystem experiments, and they've been doing this since the 1960s. And then in the 1960s, they discovered that, you know, you can limit nitrogen, you can limit carbon, it's not going to do a bit of good. You got to limit phosphorus. And they did this by, you know, dosing whole lakes with very precise amounts of phosphorus. And so what they did was they basically came up with a diet for Lake Erie, and the diet was you need to cut your phosphorus consumption by 50% and take it down to, I think it was 11,000 tons a year or something. I mean, this was science at its best. These guys were like, you know, solving real world problems. And so the you know, detergent industry, which was the largest advert, may still be, like Procter and Gamble, these guys were like big time advertisers, and they had a lot of money to tell their story, and they were resisting it. But then when you had these images, I mean, these aerial images of this lake had phosphorus. They actually cut one lake in half with a big nylon plastic curtain and gave one half phosphorus and one half not, and one half turned bright green. And they still talk about that today. They said that did anything, or that did more for the health of America's and Canada's water than any chart, graph, you know, passion's plea. It was just there, right in front of your nose. So now it's right in front of our nose again on Lake Erie. Yeah. We've got these toxic algae problems. And again, they figured out we need to do a 40% reduction in the application of commercial fertilizer in the western basin of Lake Erie, particularly in this one rivershed called the Maumee River. And so they're just as confident today as they were back then, and they were right back then, that this will solve the problem. But unlike back then, we're not following this prescription. There's resistance, you know, from the agriculture community to deal with these reductions.
Right.
And so, I mean, all these things are connected. You feel for the farmers, but then you also got to think, well, what are they growing and where is it going? And 40% of the corn that we grow today ends up as ethanol, you know, which is arguably not a net benefit to the environment. It's good for agriculture interests, but it's not for the public's water.
Right.
And so we got problems, and we have potential solutions. And the frustrating thing is unlike previous generations who stepped up and, you know, tackled these things, we're not doing that yet. And we're not doing it at our own peril.
Yeah, well, we really enjoyed the book, Dan, that's for sure. It definitely read like a history, even a thriller story. I really encourage folks to get a copy of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. You may say, well, what does this have to do with health? It really has to do. We tied it all together, Dan. Farming, the health of water, the health of the planet. It's really a microcosm and macrocosm issue here. So thanks for being my guest.
And I will say real quickly, when stuff gets into the Great Lakes, it gets out of the Great Lakes too. These boats bring it in, and it's just kind of like a beachhead for invasions that go national. I'm going to be in Lake George in a few weeks talking to them. They're in a pitched battle to keep the mussels from getting into their lakes.
Yeah, the mussels clog everything. The mussels clog. Yeah, that's that's an interesting dilemma too. And as this spreads, it's spreading like wildflower, just like, you know, invasive species of plants, people bringing in Japanese knotweed and all kinds of bamboo and things like that, thinking it's great, and it just takes over the place. So we have to be very careful with what we do and what we think, you know. It's that's the whole thing, you know. Yeah. So we can get your book anywhere, Amazon, and do you have a website, Dan, or other information?
No, it's published by W.W. Norton. It should be available in most bookstores and Amazon always. And, it came out in paperback just in April. So, there should be plenty of them out there circulating now.
Well, thanks a lot for being a guest here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Any final words?
No, I mean, just... The lakes are a great story, and it really is a national story. I got convinced of that after spending my time in New York, not just because it's interesting, but because what happens here is, you know, likely to take hold in waters across the country.
Thanks a lot, Dan, and that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.